The black community to its maximum potential through a focus on education and economics with the traits of hard work, honesty, and integrity. And for all the new listeners, for more information about PAX Inc., remember to visit their website at www.pactsinc.org. That way you can learn more about the organization, their codes of conduct, how to become a member, how to donate to the organization, how to get more involved. And if you hover your mouse over that More tab, see a drop-down box with the Learning Center. Hover your mouse over the Learning Center, and there's a total range of resources from audio, politics, books, survival, legal cases, and videos, all for your learning pleasure and your entertainment, however you want to put it in. But remember, the website is www.pactsinc.org. And while you're online, make sure you visit our Freedom Train website at www.freedomtrainradio.com. You can learn more about myself, Patrick Irvin, Enigma September, as well as our new podcast on the network, Ms. Shelby Davis. So once again, that's www.freedomtrainradio.com. Pat, what's going down on this good Sunday, my brother?
What the hook gonna be?
Oh, man, you went back to the St. Lunatics, whoever that was.
You're supposed to say I don't need no hook on this beat.
Yeah, you just surprised me with that.
You're supposed to be on the train. You ruined it.
Hey, your fault, I guess. I don't know. Somebody's fault. It's whoever from St. Louis is their fault. So. Yeah, man. So, you ready to talk about the environment, my brother?
Yeah, like the environment that we just had where you ruined it.
I got to get some drums for you. That was good. That was good. That was good.
So, I get my own drums.
Whatever. So, you know, we've been talking. We've had a couple shows over the last couple months about the environment and different things that happen to the environment, ranging from floods to massive hurricanes, forest fires, different other things, pollutants and things that mess up the environment. So, scrolling through Facebook, and our good brother, Dr. Bruce Strobel, he has an event coming up on Tuesday here in Tallahassee where he gets to actually speak about different things, environmental injustice and all those things that are going on. So I decided to, why don't we introduce the brother, well, not introduce him, but invite him on the Freedom Train so we could talk more about his event, but not just his event, but you know, the environment as well, learn what environmental injustice is, and just different things that's a strain on our environment and our communities. So before we bring him on, let me give you a quick introduction of the brother, or reintroduction to our listeners. So Dr. Strobel is a father of four and a self-described environmental justice advocate. He is committed to ensuring that black communities worldwide are prepared to adapt and respond to the global climate crisis, right? He's a 2018 recipient of the Rethink Energy Florida Energy Innovator Award and is a member of several community-based organizations. He's the founding member of Citizens for a Sustainable Future. He's a senior fellow at the Institute for the Polarities of Democracy, as well as the Environmental Leadership Program. He served on the board of directors for the Capital City Chamber of Commerce, Rethink Energy Florida, and the Moving Forward Network. In 2016, he was appointed to serve on the Leon County Affordable Housing Advisory Council. He's a research and program coordinator at FAMU, right? And he's a graduate of FAMU. So I want all y'all, to get up, put y'all hands together for the one and only Dr. Bruce Strobel Jr. Yeah. Welcome back, my brother.
What's going on? I'm glad to be back.
Man,
how y'all doing?
Happy, man. Everything is good.
I'm glad to be here, man. However I can help, any way to share information, I'm all about that.
Oh, man, we appreciate that.
Right.
Appreciate that.
Because he know what the hook going to be.
Somebody going to know it for you. For the day over with, somebody going to know it for you.
Whatever it is, I don't know what the hook going to be.
Right. So, Pat, you know how we do. You got the first question. Let's kick this thing off, my brother.
So, for those of you who ain't cool or was a little bit late to the cool
right.
school bus, we interviewed
right.
Mr. Strobel a few years back. A few years back. But, so you should go back and listen to that interview just because you want to be live. But for those people
right.
who ain't live yet, they still in the process. Why don't you fill the people
trying to
in
be somebody.
On, you know, who Bruce Strobel is and what drives Bruce Strobel?
For sure. All right, so, you know, myself, as Joseph said when he was introducing me, man, I'm an activist, I'm an advocate, and I'm really just trying to be the best resource to my community that I can. So I work at Florida A&M University. I teach classes. I work in the Sustainability Institute, but also I'm always trying to be active in the community to make sure people are aware of what's happening around us. I've been in education for as long as I can remember, and I've been doing advocacy on behalf of Black communities for as long as I can remember. Since I was a kid, it's just something that it came to me naturally. My parents encouraged it. I had family members who were activists, friends who were doing it. And then, you know, of course, going to the great institution of Florida A&M University, it just further awakened me to make sure that I was spreading awareness and making sure people were doing what would be in the best interest of our community.
That's what's up.
Y'all found you
up. Bam in your face, Pat.
Hyping yourself up, man.
God, we got to, man. We got to. Nobody else will if we don't.
Right. Don't be hating. Don't be hating on fam. You.
Hey,
you sound like BC. You sound like BCU right now.
I ain't BCU nothing. Dell State. You know. Nah.
Yes. Really. Okay. All right.
Not really.
So you mentioned that you are sustainability coordinator at FAMU. So. What is a sustainability coordinator, and what's important about your position?
All right, so to answer that question, we got to really go into what is sustainability. So basically, you take that word sustainability, and we're talking about the ability of humans or anything, or of anyone, to maintain its ability to survive over a period of time, right? So when we talk about human sustainability, we're talking about humans' ability to use the earth for its resources and extract resources from the earth without harming the earth or harming ourselves. So a lot of times they say sustainability is the ability to thrive and be successful without compromising the ability to do that in the future. So we're talking about like this whole systems approach to how FAMU operates. FAMU, like any other institutional organization, has a carbon footprint. FAMU uses resources. We get students from all over the country, all over the world, and we want to make sure that when they leave our campus that they are aware of their impact on the planet and the other issues that are happening on the planet. So at the Sustainability Institute at FAMU, which was started by Dr. Elmira Mangum, what we attempt to do is catalyze research and service on the campus and in the community that promotes this idea and this concept of sustainable living. And that's just it's ongoing work. It's very important. FAMU is one of the few HBCUs that is fortunate to have such a well-staffed sustainability department. So, yeah, I think it's really important work. And as a coordinator, any kind of sustainability projects, I'm normally organizing them trying to get people involved, trying to find funding for it, and just keep this train moving, man.
I guess I got you. So I want to ask this real quick. What's like, what actions or what things are we doing now to hurt the environment as far as, let's say we're trying to sustain our lives, but at the same time hurting the earth or the environment? Can you lay out some of those things that we do on a regular basis?
Yes. Okay. So just one thing that people do, a lot of the emissions that people cause on a day-to-day basis just come from things like leaving the lights on, you know, letting the hot water run, or idling your car in the morning. People don't recognize how much, if everyone's doing it in mass, it's a significant amount of greenhouse gases that are being released from your vehicle just on a day-to-day basis if you just leave it running when you don't need to. It's little things people could do that can make significant differences, but it's not everything. A lot of it has to do with larger systemic issues that we got to address collectively. But on a day-to-day basis, it's just using energy, using resources that you don't need, thinking that you could actually throw something away, because when you say, I'm going to throw something away, you mean you go put it in the trash, and the trash company or the garbage disposal company is going to take that to a landfill. It doesn't go away. It goes somewhere else, and we can't get rid of it. So overconsumption, overproduction, wasteful use of natural resources, these are all things that all humans contribute to. For most of us, it's through our consumption patterns and what we choose to buy, even when we don't need it. So just getting people to be conscious of it. I'm not trying to tell everybody to stop everything you're doing, but we are facing a crisis. You know, as humans continue to release more carbon and more methane and other greenhouse gases into the atmosphere, it's going to change the temperature. It's going to change the climate, and that's going to have consequences for how we live our lives on this planet, especially for our future generations.
Okay. Okay. That's good.
So, for those of you, and I do want to apologize. I'm a little bit under the weather. That's why you might hear me coughing. I try to mute myself, cover the mic, but sometimes I miss it. So, but he said, leaving your cars idling. And that's doubly true for those of you driving these 1960, 1970, 1980 model bad, hardly running vehicles out here. Don't leave them running, bro. Stop it. I don't even know why y'all doing that, because the chances are that your car is going to shut off anyways. So I don't understand why people do that. Why do people do that? I understand. No, I don't. Why do people do that, Dr. Strobel? Why do they leave their cars running?
A lot of times people just don't know. It's this idea that it's going to heat your car up. That's what the old, you know, that's what the older folks used to tell us, like, you know, go warm the car up so it can run good. Right. But what we find is that doesn't seem to be the case, and really you just burning gas for no reason. So, and when you burn that gas, that's carbon. We're putting it right into the atmosphere, and it's contributing to your individual carbon footprint. Which, you know, the whole planet has a carbon footprint that once we pass a certain amount of carbon release, that's it. That we're going to see a definite climate change or a definite average increase in temperatures. Right now, since the pre-industrial age, I think in 2017, we were about 1 degree Celsius over average increase. Once we get to 1.5, we'll see significant changes in the weather patterns and in the climate. And then if we get to 2, you know, that's a scary scenario if we get to 2. And they're predicting we'll be at 2 by around 2050, if we don't make significant changes now. We're going to get to 1.5 by 2030, so we will see some damage. But it could not be that bad if we could keep it between 1.5 and 2 degrees average temperature increase. But that's going to take a concerted effort and everyone starting to do whatever they can to make a change.
No, that's okay. People gonna have to think about the kids. Remember, Trent love the kids. Why you don't love the kids?
Trent love the kids.
Right. So I got a question.
I'm listening, brother.
So I wanna go away from the climate real quick and then come right back, cause word on the streets is you are also a professor at Florida A&M.
Yes, sir.
So I got two-part question. One of the questions is a question that I'm sure you're prepared for, And another question, you might not be, so if you don't want to answer it, you can just say, man, Patrick,
there you go.
Go for it.
It ain't that bad. So the first question I'm wondering is, what do you teach, and how does that make you feel to be able to pour back into the future of Black America teaching at a HBCU? The second question is, what do you think HBCUs are doing good at right now, and what do you think HBCUs could be doing better at?
Both good questions. What do I teach? I teach African American experience and history, political science, and public administration courses as well. Because my education focus is a mixture of social sciences with a focus on Black communities and organization development in a way that makes prepares communities to be more sustainable. So then you ask, it's interesting because that leads into your next question, what do I think HBCUs do well and what do I think they could do better? I think HBCUs do, for one thing, is the ability to survive in the circumstances that we're placed in and improving people's ability to survive and even have the potential to thrive in this this social environment that we live in. HBCUs take people from who are not the most academically prepared because of other systemic issues in our education system, but we give them a chance. They gave me a chance. They said, we know you have potential even if you don't have everything together right now. And they put you with all the other Black people, diverse groups of people who want to come to a HBCU, and then it helps you build yourself up. You build up your social network. You build up your communication skills. You build up your ability to complete assignments and solve problems, and then we put you out in the world, and you're better prepared. Now, one thing HBCUs could do better is we got to get better at making sure that we're meeting the needs of our students as generations change. So things change over time. The students change. They have new needs, and sometimes I feel the HBCUs will be lagging behind on what we're serving. So that's something that I believe they are looking to address, and they will be addressing in the near future. Going forward, HBCUs have to be able to adapt and adjust to changes in the social environment.
Okay. I have one quick off the track question. Because, you know, and I'm sure you get it too, as a graduate of HBCUs, people who have either never went to an HBCU or they had a bad experience at an HBCU, their view of it is not favorable. So that information may get out in the public. They may spread it with other people, especially young high school students or getting ready to graduate from high school, going to college, looking at different colleges, and a HBCU may or may not be on their list. So as a graduate of a HBCU and a professor at a HBCU, like what would you say to a young child to get them to understand the significance of attending an HBCU?
That nobody is – when you go to an HBCU, you're going to meet people who understand – or have a better understanding of your cultural background and scenario. Like, that's one thing when I talk to students at HBCUs, it's like moving into a bigger family experience. So you get addressed at an HBCU as if you're being a part of a family, and you're expected to contribute to that, as opposed to just going to somewhere and being a number on an attendance roster. You know, we have a vested interest in your success. If you don't succeed, we don't succeed. So that is one thing I think is critical at an HBCU, is that it's going to be like leaving from your family to go be a part of a larger family with Black people from all over the country. It's so much diversity within the Black community, I think that gets missed. That, you know, I study with brothers from Nigeria, Ghana, from New York, from California to Miami to Canada. It's brothers and sisters from everywhere. Brilliant people all at these HBCUs all over the country, because these are great places to study and great places to develop yourself in a pool of Black excellence.
There you go. You got to dive in that pool, Pat. Now, behave,
you know,
on things.
I asked him the question because I was thinking the same thing you were thinking. You know, it's a lot of people. You know, I was right there with you. I just took a different approach. You know, that's all.
Yeah. I'm messing with you. But
no,
it's just...
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead, what you can say, what I'm gonna say is gonna might steer us somewhere else.
Now I was just gonna say, I went to FAMU. I did enjoy my time. I just didn't like school as a whole, but I did enjoy my time in my major. But I was having a conversation with a guy a couple months ago, and you know, I was giving him my experience, some bad, mostly good. But he was like, man, I never send my child to HBCU. And I was like, well, I would, because I mean, you can't have the idea that black people can't get things right, and especially if you're a black person, that means you too can't get things right. So I just, you know, getting people to think more outside the box with that.
Yeah, man, real talk.
Yeah. Well, where I was coming from was just simply that, you know, we've had the conversations about HBCUs before and how their image is very non-helpful for them right now in the black community. Like, a lot of people, there are people out there starting to view HBCUs as the enemy of the community. You know, the idea that all they create is bourgeoisie black people, or black people that think that they're better than the rest of the community, things like that. So whenever, you know, we get somebody on that's a part of that institution, you know, I think it's always fair to give them a chance to give the other side to push back on that narrative. Because a lot of the times when these narratives are being created and propagated, it's from people that are on the outside looking in, are from people that may have had one bad experience, and they take this little, they take a little anecdotal story and they extrapolate all sorts of huge systemic issues that may or may not be accurate. So he teaches at one of the most prominent HBCUs in the nation.
The most prominent. Get it right.
One of the most prominent HBCUs in the nation, the illustrious Florida A&M University, FAMU. You know, he should definitely have a chance to, not to speak for the entire institution, because that wouldn't be fair either, but at least to give his perspective as somebody that's inside of the institution, if that makes sense.
Right.
Yeah, man. I know. Real talk, bro. Like, I wear my HBCU proud. Like, I don't, not even just against other HBCUs, I be in rooms with people from Yale and Harvard and MIT, and I be like, I'm just as well prepared as anybody in this room to discuss what I chose to be a specialist in. And that's the opportunity there. I had the opportunity to go to Columbia. I chose the HBCU. I'm a HBCU legacy student. So it's just, it was what was best for me. It might not be best for everybody. And as far as that whole thing about the production of bourgeoisie culture, that already exists in black America, irregardless of HBCUs or not, right? True. So those people are going to come to HBCUs as well and leave. But you also get dudes straight from your hood or any hood in here who decide they want to get educated. HBCU might be the best fit for them as well.
That's fair. That's a great point, actually. Yeah. That's a great pushback point.
Yep. So getting back on the environmental track, we hear the term a lot about environmental racism, and I think sometimes people may think they have a good idea of, and some people may have a good idea of what environmental racism, but could you break down what environmental racism is and how it negatively affects our black communities?
Yes. All right. So environmental racism is the exposure of hazards and environmental burdens and the disproportionate access to environmental benefits of a group of people based on the color of their skin, right? Mm-hmm. So when we talk about environmental racism, what we're looking at is that in the United States and across the planet, black and brown people get exposed to the majority of the environmental hazards more so than whites. White people get the majority of the privileges, or what we call ecosystem services, the benefits that come from having a clean environment. That goes to white people in a very disproportionate fashion, whereas the hazards of the exposure to climate change impacts, the exposure to toxic chemicals, the lack of access to fresh food, that's what you're going to find blacks and Latinos suffer from the most. Particularly in this country and around the world, you'll find people of color, whether it be in Cambodia or in the Sudan, parts of East Africa, in South America, around the Panama Canal, here in the United States, in Savannah, Georgia, or Newark, New Jersey, or Houston, Texas. You're just going to see right where they're building these facilities where there's chemicals there. They call them fence line communities. The majority of the people in those communities, many times, are going to be black and brown. So, again, when we talk about environmental racism, it's not, we don't know that someone's sitting in a boardroom saying, you know what, let's put this chemical plant that pollutes right here next to the black people or to the Latinos. But what they are doing is saying, we know that these chemicals we're emitting are killing black and brown people, but we're making so much money, as long as there's not enough white people trying to oppose us, we're not going to change it. So that's what environmental racism looks like today in this country.
Okay. Okay. And you know, and as you're saying that, in my mind, a great example is what's happening in Flint. But in that, could you kind of bring more light to not just what's happening in Flint to the water, but other cities and other states around the country, black communities, as far as like the water crisis or the environmental racism that's affecting the water supply?
Yes, sir. All right. So with water, we got some serious issues. And you know what? It's crazy because the lead poisoning that's happening in Flint, that is something that people think is that, like, if you said, where's lead poisoning the worst in the country? Because Flint is well popularized, that's the one that's going to come up. But when you do the research, man, like, Flint is just one of a couple thousand communities like that. And you heard, I didn't say 400. I said a couple thousand communities across the country where the people are being exposed to water with lead in it. And lead is not just something that it's like, oh, it's just some natural metal in this water. Like, lead has significant impacts on people when they consume it in high amounts. So what you'll find is that people who are exposed to lead is going to impact their ability to learn. It impacts their academic performance, reductions in their IQ, decline in their ability to solve problems. It increases cases of ADHD, and also increases your chance to develop Alzheimer's disease later in your life. And then we got even more reports saying that it impacts the part of your brain that is responsible for your impulse control. So people's ability to regulate their emotions and not behave violently, that could be impacted by lead. So when you look at these communities, I think it's about 2,600 census tracts across the country with twice what's happening in Flint, and they all have high crime issues. And I saw a lot of research recently where they're looking and saying, as we started to mitigate lead issues in communities, we saw the crime rates decrease. In areas where it's still high lead exposure, we saw crime increasing. So that's just one issue with water. You got, for example, the Navajo Nation, they had a couple decades ago, they had a uranium mine explosion that put uranium in their water, and then the EPA and the government was just like, go ahead and drink it. You know, we're not going to do nothing about it. It's because what happens is, like with any other kind of racism, black people and brown people normally do not have the political connections and the economic strength behind them to force some of these changes through, and they have to depend on the government or people who are willing to do charitable work to come to their defense. So when that it doesn't happen, we end up with this situation where black and brown people are overexposed to environmental hazards, and it has dramatic effects on our economic, political, and social performances.
Right. Wow, that's deep. That's deep. And just one more thing. What they call it? It was a movie by the called Toxic Skies. What's that? You know, when the planes,
the chemtrails.
Yeah, the chemtrails. Because a lot of people think chemtrails is a myth. Are chemtrails real, and how badly are they affecting our communities, from your understanding?
All right, so my research on chemtrails is not as thorough. I have heard a lot of people saying that it's something going on, but I haven't seen, like, documented scientific data. And excuse me for my ignorance, I haven't seen the documented scientific data to say these chemtrails have these direct results in these communities. And I just don't know if there's enough research out there to make a hard claim. Like, if you were to ask me about carbon or black carbon, something I know that comes from a coal fire plant, I can tell you, because I've seen so much research on it, that I can say if you put this coal plant in this community, this is what's going to happen to the majority of people here. But if I saw a chemtrail, I couldn't give you any kind of predictive consequences of what might happen. But I have heard a lot of talk about it. I've heard a lot of, like, you know, word of mouth about it. So I believe there's something there, and we desperately need more research on what is in the chemtrails, what toxins are actually being released.
Okay.
I think that's what matters.
Okay.
Well, what's your question, Joe? I'm curious.
No, I just, because, you know, we hear a lot of, over the years, just heard a lot of people talk about chemtrails, and I've heard some people, you know, YouTube videos. That's why I want to ask somebody who's actually studying the environment, not just go off of that, but I've heard people go into deep discussions about what's in the chemtrails and how the chemtrails negatively affect us. So I just wanted to kind of get some empirical data on that.
Yeah, and that's the issue for me, is I just haven't seen the numbers that, because I don't think, I don't know how you would test and say, okay, you would have to get access to, okay, here was what was in this chemtrail when they released it, we got an air sample, and this is the impact of these chemicals, right? So it's hard to say. I haven't seen that level of research yet. Not to say it's not out there, but I just haven't seen it.
Okay, that's fair.
I don't think it's out there, and I'll say that because I'm a nerd or a geek or whatever. I love reading. I read research papers for fun. That's what kind of person I am. Go ahead, pick on me. That's cool.
We like me, bro.
That's good. You smart.
But I haven't read anything about, like you, Bruce, and I've actually looked into it. And I've read a lot of things that suggest a lot of things. I've read a lot of reports that put a lot of theories out there, a lot of ideas with no real data to back it up. And I've even read things about what they have released in the past. And by in the past, I mean, you know, 15, 20 years ago. But no real data about what's going out, what's coming out now. So it's whenever I hear about the chemtrail thing, because, Joe, you're right, we hear about chemtrails often. It's kind of like it's one of those things where we just don't know. So instead of fighting and arguing and mobilizing and doing this and that and this for chemtrails, let's go back to, until we can get the data and the research, let's go back to the things we do know about, the water issues that are going on all over the country. And like you just said, that stuff is affecting the IQs, the intelligence, the mental capabilities of the people in those communities, and not just the adults, but also the children, you know, and what sort of impact is that having on a developing fetus? Are the kids going to be born with permanently lowered IQs, where now you're producing a population of people who can't fight back mentally, even if they want to, because they don't have the mental ability to do so? You know, so
now you talk.
Those are the issues that really keep me up at night. The chemtrails thing is interesting, though. I would love, Joe, mate, why don't you do that? Why don't you get some people together and start a research organization to research chemtrails?
Hey, man, you know, you're going, I just need 50 cents from you to get started. So
I got
you.
Chemtrails thing is interesting, though. I do wish we had more data. I was curious too. I was like, well, shit, what's Bruce gonna say? That's a good ass question.
Yeah. But look, the reason if the chemtrails is doing anything, I just can't imagine what more they're doing, because the air is already so fucked up, man. Like, we got nitrogen dioxide, sulfur dioxide, particulate matter, all in the in ozone, you know, that's O3, right? All that stuff in the air, that's giving our kids asthma. It's giving people heart disease. It's contributing to our infant mortality in our communities. Like, all this stuff is happening on a day-to-day basis. It's just being dumped right into black and brown communities. And then you look at the water is polluted, the soil is contaminated, and then it's like, what do you expect people to do? People are going to get sick. It's clear. And then people don't have health insurance, bro.
Yeah. Nah, but what as you guys are talking, things start to make sense to me because, you know, I do a lot of work in the communities, in the black communities, low-income communities, and there isn't a lot of pushback from the people, like, in the communities that are greatly affected by this environmental racism. And what you guys are saying makes everything, like, full circle, because that will be a great factor into why people are not, they just don't care. It's not something that's high up the ladder for them, because it's a lot of things that have already affected them. So that would be one of the main reasons why.
Yeah. And you know, another part of it is people don't know. Like, you can't see the, well, sometimes you can. Like, some of them, they have pink smoke coming out the tower of the facility, and the people smell it and get sick. So they know. But a lot of times it's invisible. You can't see the particulate matter. Ozone is small, so you can see ozone some of the time. But you can't always see particulate matter. You might be able to have it has a distinct, it might have a distinct odor sometimes. But for the most part, people are just getting sick and they don't know why. But we do have, like, all over the country, we got environmental justice organizations fighting this. But here's what's happening in the environmental movement. We got these big white organizations that are, you know, they have good intentions at times, but they get the lion's share of the money that's put into the environmental movement. Then they want to go and they like to dole out the money as they see fit or solve the problems that they identify as a priority. The black and Latino organizations, we get left fighting with each other over the crumbs or trying to divide the crumbs up amongst ourselves, and we can't get the work done as effectively as we would like to. So I am a part of some coalitions, for example, the Moving Forward Network, and they focus mostly on pollution that comes in port communities and on freight. So if you live right next to the freeway or you live next to a huge airport or a port like on the coast, for example, like in Savannah, Georgia, or the port in New Jersey or in Long Beach, California, then what you see there is that those places get bombarded with a hell of a lot of pollution. So we organize around the country and trying to find ways to push back. We go visit with our congressional leaders. We write to senators. We do local organizing activities. And we have recently our Zero Emissions campaign and our Act for Community Health. And it's just trying to make sure that people are aware. So it is people out there, but like I said, we are under-resourced, and we are fighting against the most powerful enemies you could imagine, like the supervillains, Texaco, Exxon, British Petroleum. Like, these people got billions of dollars, and they run these beautiful campaigns to make it look like they're really pursuing these clean energy strategies, when in reality they're just trying to make more money, man. And that's who we up against. Right. And plus they got the president and his cabinet on their side. They got the EPA. The EPA is pretty much subdued at this point, under control of the president. So our communities are almost defenseless outside of people like us and these EJ activists, like Dr. Bob Buller or Dr. Mildred McLean in Savannah, my homeboy Mark Lopez out in Long Beach with E-Sharps for Community Justice, E-Sharps Community for Environmental Justice, like my homeboy Juan Paras and Judith. It's just a lot of EJ activists that I know and I see doing the work, and that's what inspires me. Like, I'm trying to keep up with them because they go hard. They give their whole lives to this struggle. And you'll see it's because they're personally invested in it. They got family members they lost and friends who died and brothers and sisters having asthma attacks, and they're trying to make changes.
Okay. Now, that makes sense. We need that, though.
What you just said, though, is so because and this is off subject but on subject at the same time, because when you started, you were talking about how you got all of these white environmental justice organizations, and they mean well. But, you know, and that's one of the things that pushes me. Like, I do social work, but I'm so hesitant to get involved in larger movements, because when you look into the history, it's littered with people that meant well and did horrible things. And so at what point do we as a community, not just as a black community, because I definitely think it's needed on that level, but just as a progressive community, begin to say, all right, your intentions are fucking people up, so we need to train you on how to align your intentions with the community that you're going to serve. Like, when does that happen? When do we stop telling people, well, you meant well, all we need is for you to try to do better? No, that is not all we need. That might be good enough for the white communities because you're white. But it's not good enough for other communities that have a different culture from you. At what point do social movements begin to deliver that message to all of these well-meaning white folk out here fucking shit up?
I think that that's beginning. It's not happening fast enough for my liking, but what I will say is that when I'm going to events recently, that's been a common theme. And I think it was the sister, I can't think of her name, but she did a lot of research on how the white environmentalist movement was kind of racially segregated. And I think, you know, some people got defensive, but other, you know, the people who was really true about it, they looked at themselves and they said, you know what, we're making mistakes. We need to put environmental justice at the forefront of our environmental movement. And I respect those organizations. You know, it's some good organizations in Florida. One organization I work with is Rethink Energy Florida, and they're all about environmental justice and a just energy transition for all Floridians. And I respect that. And that's why I'll serve on that with that organization. I'll work with them. But then there's other ones where they got to prove it to us. You know what I mean? It's certain organizations, they have their own interest, and until they prove it, we shouldn't put our efforts into working with them until they get on board with the idea that we have to take care of our most vulnerable populations first.
Right. Right. So on the 29th, October 29th at 6:30 p.m., you have a event, which is a lecture series where you're doing environmental injustice, working on sustainable communities and trying to save the climate and or looking at the climate crisis. So can you give us some information about the event? And you don't have to go into full detail, but what exactly you'll be talking about at this event?
All right, so this is the Razor Lecture Series. It's a series of lecturers people who've been doing research on stuff. So my topic is environmental justice, vulnerable communities surviving the climate crisis. And the theme here is based off a lot of the research I've done and also my experience working in the environmental justice and climate justice movements. And basically what I'll be sharing is just the different ways that we've gotten to this situation, what we could expect in the future, and also with our already vulnerable environmental justice communities, communities that are impacted by environmental racism, what's going to happen to them as things start to worsen as the climate starts to change. Like, they already are suffering from toxic pollution, and now it's going to be hotter every day, or it's going to be floods. People are going to be they're going to be displaced. We're going to see increased gentrification, increased income and inequality and political inequality around the globe. We saw what happened just recently, our brothers and sisters trying to move from the Bahamas after the recent hurricane, and Trump is telling them no. We're dealing with a new type of climate apartheid right now. So I just want to bring this to everyone's awareness and share with them a lot of the statistics on it that they may not be privy to. But since it's my job to look at this stuff all day, it's like I got all this stuff in my head, so I put together this lecture, and I really just want to make sure people are informed. And then also, the last part of it, I'll be talking about the role that a lot of times the idea is to prevent this, we invest in the physical infrastructure of the community. We want to build walls. We want to build up the houses and make them stronger. But none of that means anything if you don't invest in the community's social infrastructure. So I'll be talking about that as well.
Will your president want to build some walls?
But even speaking to him, like I know it. It makes me angry, so I wonder how angry does it make you to hear the president continue to act like these environmental issues are a myth or climate change isn't real? Like how, and when you get that, how do you counter that? What information do you use to counter his ignorance?
So, man, I heard a sister talking not too long ago, and she talked about this time. This is the Naomi Klein, right? And she said, what we're seeing is the beginning of climate barbarism. She said Trump and his stooges, they don't actually deny, like they might publicly deny climate change, but when you look at their actions, they're preparing for it. They're looking for a way that they could benefit from it and advance white supremacy through the changes in the climate. So we're going to see them refusing to help people of color who they have been the reason that they've contributed to the situation that puts them in the increased vulnerability. So a lot of new terms, climate fascism, climate barbarism, but really it's the expansion of white supremacy through using climate-related disasters to increase inequality. So, yeah, man, when I hear people denying it, it's like, you know, it's hard to – I used to argue with people a lot, but I've gotten to a point where it's like, I mean, I treat climate change deniers the same way I treat flat earthers or people who don't believe in gravity. Well, if you don't believe it, then don't do anything. Just wait and see what happens. But, you know, I think people like being contrarian, man. They just like to be on the opposite side for the sake of being opposite.
I agree with that.
Yeah.
I do.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even the most well-meaning of people. Yeah. Nah.
That's
dope, though. That everything is starting to tie in, because when you were talking, it made me think about this report that came out, I think it was last year, maybe the year before last, that the Road to Zero Wealth, where...
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, they looked out, and they basically said, unless we do something drastic, the wealth of the black community, or the wealth of black and brown communities as a whole, we're going to trickle down to be zero. By
2040
or 2050, yeah. Yeah, so you tie that in to the climate issues that we've been dealing with for decades now. And then
exactly.
You mesh that in with the health issues that are really starting to pop up and are being exacerbated by our lack of access to quality health care and our distrust of the medical field as a whole. And our lack of, you know, having people in those sections to provide that service for us. And you just get, like, this big-ass mess that black people are running into face first that is just scary as shit to look at.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, exactly. We got two looming crises. By 2050, we might be at 2 degrees climate, 2 degrees average temperature increase, and black net wealth could hit zero. We're going to see sea level rise that we haven't seen in our lifetimes, floods, it's a storm, just daytime floods in certain areas. Certain areas are going to need to be evacuated. We'll have people moving from all over the state of Florida into the inner areas like Orlando, Atlanta, Tallahassee.
Yeah.
We could be looking for maybe 50,000 people migrating over the next couple of years. We don't got enough affordable housing for that. Where are these people going to live?
Right.
You know what I'm saying? So climate change does is it exacerbates our other problems that we already hadn't been able to take care of. So these are the things that our black community leaders are, this is why we had a FAMU. This is where FAMU is, and this is why I work at that Sustainability Institute, is because we got to start getting these people, our best problem solvers, to be thinking about how we're going to address this issue. And that's what I'm always challenging my students to do. These issues are coming. You are the people, your parents, your church, your community sent you here, not for you to just come and get rich. We need you to come and figure out how we could solve these problems.
Right.
What are you going to create? What are you going to invent? What new system are you going to put in place? How are you going to be an educator that prepares other students to deal with this? Like, you know, we got to make – this is how we adapt. And the adaptation is necessary for our survival. So FAMU, Bethune – all the HBCUs, and any black person listening, if you're going to school or if you're not going to school, how are you going to contribute to helping our people survive this crisis?
Yeah. And y'all ain't got a lot of time to figure it out, neither.
Right, right. Because people think, like, you know, 30 years is a long time. It's really not a long time. So we got to do something now. And like, not now, but now. So, yeah. So, quick, I want to ask this. Since we're talking about, we're discussing different solutions, from your experience and your research, can you give us some tips on things that we can do on a daily basis that can help mitigate some of these issues that's in our community?
All right, they're not easy, man, but I think there's some simple things. But when I say them to people, they've been looking at me like I'm crazy. All right. So you know, just to start building sustainable practices, right? So personally, I've been striving to move away from plastic straws, even though I understand some people still need the straws, and that is not the solution to the climate change problem, but it's a sustainable practice that we should embrace. It's just something small we could do to, as a practice, you know, to get us thinking about the issue. The use of plastic bottles, I try to reduce that. Just reducing your use of anything that you don't need, reducing how much you reduce unnecessary travel, and then also changing our dietary patterns because we got to get healthier, right? So limiting your meat consumption. I'm not telling people to get a meat up. I'm just saying we need to start thinking about how do we limit it because it's going to happen anyway. The price of meat is going to be going up over the next several years. The price of certain foods is going up also. So we got to get in better control of what we consume and our consumption patterns. So I say that in general to summarize all those things. Improve your consumption patterns and start being better at building relationships within your community and with other communities. We need to be able to build relationships between one another, understanding where the resources are in our communities. And we also need to start having community-wide plans. What are we going to do if there's a flood? What are we going to do if there's a massive hurricane that knocks the power out for multiple weeks and we know we got elders, we got women with young children that are vulnerable, we got disabled individuals who need our help, and the local government might not be able to respond on its own. So what's the plan for the black community? We don't want to get caught like we saw with Hurricane Katrina where our brothers and sisters were just stranded out there waiting for George Bush to come save them. And I don't think Donald Trump is coming to save us if we're in that situation anywhere. So people got to be talking at the neighborhood level. What is our plan? What will we do if this happened to us? And I believe through that process, going through that planning process, that would be incredible in terms of just getting us to connect with one another and understand the need for a community.
Right, yeah, and we saw that here on a small scale when the Cat 5 came through. You know, it didn't directly hit Tallahassee, but it knocked a lot of power out. And it destroyed Mexico Beach down in the Panama City area. And, you know, here, we see it here when a hurricane is on its way, people are scrambling at the last minute, water, certain foods, certain sustainable things that we need, gas, all these things. It's like, see lines and lines and people just panicking. It's like, yeah, I like what you're saying because it could eliminate a lot of those things.
Yeah. Yep. So we need to be thinking about being proactive, man.
There you go.
Well,
there you go.
Yeah. Right. You think that's possible? You think it's possible for us to be proactive?
If it's not, then I don't know what we gonna do, bro. Like, it has to be. I have to think it. Even if I haven't seen good evidence of it, it's necessary for our survival at this point. Because as black Americans, I think we have to have reached a point where we realize that when the shit hit the fan, white America is not going to save us. They're going to do what's best for them. And, I mean, in all fairness, I don't think we should expect them to save us. We have to be able to look out for ourselves at this point. We haven't had that great racial healing at this point. So, I mean, I'm willing to accept help from anywhere and anyone, but ultimately I feel that the responsibility for making sure the black community is ready, it falls on us. So, we don't have no choice. We got to do it.
The reason I asked that question, and as an educator, I'm sure you can enlighten me to some things. I don't know that we're grooming the next generation not to look for white people. I think the way they're being groomed is to, when there's a problem, somebody's going to come help you. And if they don't, once you get through, there's a white person you can blame on the other side. Like, that seems like that's the direction we're taking our youth. Am I wrong in viewing that, or is there something else happening on college campuses?
No, you are right to a degree. That is something that is unfortunately being taught and transmitted by people who may just not know any better. But I also see it being challenged. So that's the good part of it, is that there are more and more people starting to challenge it as well. So I couldn't say which one is more or less, but I think You know, that's the significance of this show right here, the Freedom Train, and all the other shows that are doing something similar, and all the people who are trying to make changes, is that, you know, this is something that we need to focus on, is making sure our people could be proactive on these issues instead of just waiting to blame white people after the fact. Yeah, I'm with you on that one, bro. So I believe, like I said, I believe it's possible, but yeah, you're spot on. It has not been done enough right now.
All right. So not everybody wants to get into environmental justice. So, like, who are some of the people, what are some of the things that you encountered or you learned along your way before, like, going to college that really inspired you to take this path and not just take the path but be a champion at it as you are today?
You know, it's interesting. Like, I came into environmental justice just from a general black civil rights kind of approach. So I was trying to figure out, well, you know, what is the problem that we have in the black community where we just can't perform as well as our constituents and other our counterparts in other communities? And what I started to see is just that, you know, our communities are lacking in certain areas that we need to improve. And it was like, well, why are we having these health issues? Why are we having these economic issues? Why can't we get organized? And then I started to say, what are the problems facing the black community? And I was like, wait a minute. You mean our communities are getting polluted more than other communities? That's why people are getting sick more than people in other communities? Like, it's all part of the same system. It's not really anything that's separate. So if you got an issue with police brutality, or you got an issue with children underperforming in school, or black people not being represented in the government, you working on environmental justice, whether you recognize it or not. Because at one point or another, those issues are tied to something going on in the economy or the environment, and those things are interrelated. So you can't get away from it.
Yeah, that's true. You got to pay. We all have to pay attention because, I mean, you have no environment, people going to die, just like that.
The food, bro. What you going to eat?
Yeah. Right. Yeah, you can't eat off Cheetos.
So, exactly.
I could try.
Yeah, but that also goes into like food deserts and things like that, because I'm just thinking about here in Tallahassee, the Southside community,
yep.
Texas Street, Houlton Street. They're literally in the middle of food deserts. So not only are they bombarded with these environmental issues as far as the pollutants, but the food is bad.
So a food desert is an environmental justice concern. We say climate food justice is environmental justice. Like I said, when we define environmental justice, it's the benefits from the environment and the hazards. So if you get disproportionate access to the benefits, food being a benefit of the environment, that's an environmental justice issue.
And it also made me think of the documentary What the Health. And as they were talking about different things with the meat, but they also showed a part where I think it was a county in North Carolina where they were dumping a lot of feces and using that feces, kind of spraying the water and directly affecting the black communities around there. And I'm like, well, if you just take that part out of that documentary, just kind of analyze that, that's a great example of what environmental racism or environmental injustice is, and how talked about. These companies found a way to benefit financially off of making us sick.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
Ding, ding, ding. You got it. That's it. So that's, like I said, it's all connected.
Right.
There it is, right there. So now you an environmental champion, bro.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, because we try our best on this podcast to talk about things that are going on in the environment as much as possible, to make people aware, to also spark people to do things different. I know I'm doing things different in my personal life, in my environment, making sure something as simple as picking up trash off the ground.
Yeah.
Just things like that. I know Pat talks about how he and his kids go out and pick up trash. So.
I like that. But another thing, learn how to grow food. That's something we could do for our environment.
Yeah.
Learn how to grow food. That's right there. It's fighting environmental justice issues. Fighting environmental injustice, I should say.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, so, yeah.
Get it out.
Yeah, I feel you, bro. I know exactly what you think.
Right. Now, but, all right, so as an educator, as an activist, as a father, just as a black man, along your journey, what are some of the greatest lessons that you've learned that helped you be as successful as you are, and how do you translate those lessons to your family and the community that you serve?
Man, it ties back to something we talked about earlier from the HBCUs and the bourgeoisie. Like, in working in environmental justice, one thing that is beautiful to me is, like, I could go anywhere and be like, I got a PhD in this, I'm Dr. So-and-so, and the people in the community, they're like, I don't give a damn about your PhD. What is your experience in this community? What have you done here to help us? If not, sit down with the rest of the people and listen and learn. And I love it, right? It's humbling. It's like, your credentials don't matter. The currency is your experience in helping the community. So what happens for me is, like, although I had these credentials, I had to come back and be like, okay, I got to get more community involved, because if not, I don't have no connection to the people. And I wish that that was something that was more widespread, that so that we wouldn't have that idea of just creating a bourgeoisie elite black class that's separated from the rest of us, right? So,
right.
You know, one thing that's always been important to me was being reputable in the community, being that people know that I'm there for the benefit of the community and that I'm someone they could rely on as a resource to help. So that's been my lesson right there, is that nothing really matters. When we fight these issues, it's the trust you build based off the relationships you build, and your degrees, your money, that's not going to be what does it. It's going to be your value system and the effort that you're willing to put in.
I got you. That makes sense. Definitely makes sense. And that's another reason why we was happy to have you on here, because, you know, I personally see your work in the community. You know, I run into you in the community doing things. So that's a great way you articulated that, because people who are listening to this can understand that no matter your credentials or your experience, your certificates, whatever, if you're not translating it back to the community and you're not really serving people, then you just did it for ego purposes. And we don't need that.
Exactly.
Right. So, yeah. What message would you give to the community as far as from an environmental perspective? What message would you give to the community that could help keep us safe in our environment from the threats that we face?
Man, if we don't fight and we don't come together on this, the chances of us making it are slim. Like, we don't have a choice. It's like, I know everybody come from families probably similar to mine in some capacity, where we were taught, like, you know, if you don't run from, you don't run from a bully. You know what I mean? Like, you have to stand up for yourself. And that's what we have to do as a community. We being bullied with all this pollution, and it's time for us to stand up. And I remember having to be like, hey, my family is here with me, and I'm not going to run. So that's how I feel about the community, is like, hey, I'm here with y'all, and we're going to take this challenge all the way to whatever it takes to get them to stop, because these people are going to keep going. They're going to keep fracking. They're going to keep polluting. They're going to keep poisoning the water. They're going to keep putting stuff in the air, and we're going to just be there taking our kids to the hospital, getting bills that we can't pay. So we have to stand up to them. You know what I mean?
Right.
Right. It's necessary.
Right, and you made me think about something like what I guess the extent of racism and ignorance mixed together when Trump was, you know, with the coal miners and, like, especially West Virginia and Trump, because these people kind of, they believe in Trump, but that belief is harmful to them as far as the environmentally or health wise with the coal mines and things like that. You just made me think about that. Like, it's a great contradiction in there with those people, because you're supporting a man who's helping to directly hurt you.
Exactly.
That's crazy.
That's what we up against.
Right. So, all right, so we're down to our final question, and this is Pat's question, and you know Pat's special, so we're gonna set Pat's question up a little something like this.
Okay.
So, sorry, I was in the middle of a call. If you were the all-powerful ruler of Black America, what would you change, and what would your message to the people be?
Man, great question. I think I would make Black people, I'm a ruler, I would make Black people create a Bill of Rights in their own constitution that they would make as a demand to anybody who we work with. Anyone, any other community we supported, they had to agree to these are the rules by how all Black people will be treated. If you can't adapt this into your own government structure, we can't get down with you. And that would include that we demand absolute environmental justice. We wouldn't take anything less. We demand equal protection under the law, things of that nature. It has to be our, there is no deal. There is no unity between our community.
That makes sense. That's a great answer. And it's because we like asking that question because we get different answers. That's one of the greatest answers I can remember. So, yeah, because rules of engagement are needed.
Exactly.
All right.
Yeah,
so,
that's a good answer. We haven't gotten that answer before.
Right.
And I think the last time we interviewed you, we didn't ask you that question.
Yeah. That's a good question.
Yeah. So, all right, but once again, before we let you go, I just want to remind people about your event. It's coming up on October 29th. Here in Tallahassee at the Challenger Learning Center, October 29th at 6:30 p.m. The Razor Lecture Series. The great Dr. Bruce Strobel Jr. is talking about environmental justice, things that can go into sustainable communities and being able to survive the climate crisis. So before we let you go real quick, can you tell people how they can contact you or learn more about some of the work that you're doing in the community?
Hey, please just hit me up on Facebook, man. I take messages from anybody, or you can email me. My name, BruceStrobel@gmail.com. My IG or my Twitter also. I'm active on social media because I'm always looking to build relationships and connections with anybody trying to get down with the work, man.
All right. You heard it here first. It's the Dr. Bruce Strobel Jr., a warrior for environmental justice and also fighting racism, man. It was a pleasure having you on here. We had a great conversation. We definitely learned a lot. I know I did, about some things that I didn't know was truly affecting our community. And we thank you for expounding on certain topics, especially like the lead and the water. And it's just bringing things full circle that Pat and I have been talking about in the past. So we'll definitely talk to you in the future and make sure we pump the hell out of your event so people can support you.
I appreciate you, brother. I can't wait to come back, man.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. We appreciate you, man. We'll definitely talk to you later.
All right, Pat. Peace, man.
Yep.
All right. See you later. Yeah. So, like y'all heard, he's on Facebook at Bruce Strobel Jr., so make sure you all check him out, support the man, all my Tallahasseans. Get to the Razor Series on October 29th. That's Tuesday at 6:30 p.m. at the Challenger Learning Center. Support somebody who's fighting for you. That's what we got to do. So, hey, Pat, you got any parting shots, my brother? Or last words, or first words, or middle words, however you want to do it?
Drink the water before it's not wet no more.
Yeah, man. Yeah, drink. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Dope.
And always look with your eyes closed.
Right.
Bam. That's it. Hey, it's the Freedom Train podcast series where we give you some of everything. You know, no topic that affects our community is off limits, and we are the ones who don't mind pushing the limit because we can. Because if you don't like us, the only thing you can do is not listen to us, and but that's not going to stop us from doing what we do. But we love what we do. We love our community, and we love making sure that we have conversations like this on a regular basis. So I'm your homeboy, Joseph Ward. He's your homeboy, Patrick Irvin. Remember, check us out on our website at www.freedomtrainradio.com and all of your podcast streaming platforms, Stitcher, Radio Public, iTunes, Spotify, Google Play. I said iTunes already. But, you know, all your podcast platforms. So, and if we're not on it, hit us up and let us know. Our social media handles on Facebook at Freedom Train Network, Instagram, Freedom Train Network, Twitter, Freedom Train Net. And once again, our website is www.freedomtrainradio.com. With that being said, two fingers in the air like a real player, because y'all know we up out of here. And we'll holler at you.